This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Hi, I'm Lester Graham. Today we look at Michigan's worst scoring schools and the problems they face despite partnering with the state to improve things.
Specifically, partnership districts are really struggling getting certified teachers.
The Pure Michigan Tourism campaign people are putting out a music album which starts with nature recordings from state parks.
Not just laid behind as a bed for the music, but synthesized into whole new sounds.
In Lansing, they're talking about the indictment of a legislator. Our political commentators will look at the role of money in politics.
The combination of money and politics is never good.
And a new Michigan spirit that disappears quickly.
And I said to her, "What have you done to go through that much absinthe?"
We'll show you exactly why. Plus, a new Maya Lin exhibit opens at the Grand Rapids Art Museum. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. So what is Michigan doing about its lowest performing schools? You might remember former Governor Rick Snyder took control of the school reform office, which had been a part of the Michigan Department of Education. And the concern in 2015 was that the more than 100 low scoring schools would be closed, and many of them were in Detroit. Well, 2 years later, the former governor moved the department, the office, back under the department, and the state decided building a partnership with failing schools, offering additional support, could help make the schools more successful. It's been a while since we checked in on the progress, so we thought we'd do that now. Joining me is Bill Pearson, who directs the Partnerships District Program for the Michigan Department of Education. Thanks. Come in. Welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start with some numbers. How many schools were closed before this partnership project began?
There were no schools closed. There were a couple of PSAs that decided that they were going to close, but we have not closed. The Michigan Department of Education has not closed any schools in the public school setting.
How many schools in the state are currently under partnership agreements?
We have 112 schools in 33 districts that have a partnership agreement.
How do you go about deciding whether a school should be part of a partnership?
We focused on which school districts, which PSAs were struggling with respect to their CSI score, the index score that is provided to each district from 0 to 100. And then it was determined which districts would be selected. There were three rounds. Round one, eight districts were selected. And then round two and three were within a couple of months of each other, and 25 more districts were selected. And when I use districts, PSA is a district, public school academy. So in round one, the eight districts, each partnership agreement is 3 years. And in round one, 2 years have passed in that partnership agreement. So we're getting to the third year starting this fall.
Well, let's talk about what the help looks like. What kind of help do the schools get? I realize that a lot of these are customized for the school district.
Well, each district has a liaison from the partnership office, and most liaisons work with six or seven school districts, and they have monthly meetings, quarterly meetings. They work with them asking what barriers can they help break down. What offices at the Michigan Department of Education can assist to help students achieve and get systems in place so that no matter what occurs in the future, whether the superintendent leaves, there's board turnover, administrator turnover, if the systems are there, then we know that the district is on the right track. And that's part of what makes a district a partnership district. The systems have broken down within each district, and the activities that need to take place from the administrative level, the board level, all the way down to the teaching level, need some assistance. And that could be a strategic plan. Some districts don't have a strategic plan that will focus on student achievement. We have functions here from the Michigan Department of Education, MIXL Blueprint Program, TSS, that will help struggling school districts identify the things that they need to put in place so that student achievement will occur.
Okay, so let me understand this better. What would this look like in the classroom?
If a district was using MTSS, for example, then they would have a team that would look at student data and the student data would indicate these are the areas that the students are deficient in, and then they would develop a program of how they would assist individual students in different tiers. And when they look at the data and teams get together to look at how we can help students, then student achievement should occur. But again, I want to point out there needs to be stability within the district from the top that is working together on a strategic plan so money can be designated towards the things that they want to work on. If you don't have the proper staff development, you don't have administrator, principal that understands instruction, and you don't have the top-down leadership in place, then it won't get to the classroom. So I'm working on building the processes and systems in a district so that it will reach the classroom.
What do you find failing schools need the most?
Well, right now, our partnership districts, it's a real struggle in the state of Michigan finding certified teachers, specifically in special ed, in math, some middle school and high school positions. It's affecting all districts, but specifically partnership districts are really struggling getting certified teachers. There, some of our districts do not have certified teachers in place to teach students. So there are long-term substitutes. There's other methods that they use, and that's a real struggle.
Why is that happening?
Well, I think this decade there are less high school students that are choosing to go into education at the university or college level. There's a lot of reasons for that. I think some of it is the reduction in pay for teachers. They heard about, we're going to close schools. There was some attack on education. And that's why we went to the partnership model as opposed to a system where we were just going to, go to try to close. We're trying to closure could happen in a district at the end of the partnership agreement, but reconstitution could take place also. That could be moving some teachers out of a building. That could be working diligently with the ISD on a more prolonged basis. We're not sure exactly how that will look. But it's a real problem for the districts in our partnership agreement.
So these partnerships last 3 years. I guess how will you know whether they're worth saving or not at the end of the day, at the end of the term?
Well, I think there's two paths. One path is the processes that are put in place, the systems that are put in place. If we believe that a district is on the right track now, they're better organized, they have a strategic plan that they're going to follow, they have a budget that is sustainable, and they can provide the dollars to the strategic plan, then our hope is that districts that are identified with partnership schools that are CSI schools, that's the bottom 5% on the index score. Our hope is that these districts, partnership districts, will not have any schools identified in the bottom 5%. Then we can focus on other districts.
So you're always going to have a bottom 5%. I mean, that's the way it works, right? So is this going to continue on and on and on?
Currently, that's what the model is. Yes, there's going to be a bottom 5%, and we have to identify those schools, and we will continue to do that. And some districts could be released from the partnership agreement if we believe the systems are in place and they have reduced the number of CSI schools, the bottom 5%. I mean, that is possible. Then, if they are released and a couple of schools go back to the bottom 5%, we could start another partnership agreement with them and work on some different systems. But hopefully, we'll be able to assist these districts so that they will have systems in place. And a lot of that is going to be based on the stability that is provided in the district. Some of the superintendent turnover is an issue for us also, because when you have a new superintendent or an interim superintendent, that kind of makes the progress lag behind a little bit, and then we have to catch up. So that's another barrier that we're facing.
So of the groups you've been working with, the school districts you've been working with in these three groups, how are we doing? Are you expecting all of them to, you know, make enough improvement to stay open, or are you looking at some that you pretty well know are not going to make it?
Well, we in our round one, we have eight districts, and of the eight districts, we did an 18-month benchmark review, which is halfway through the agreement, and of the eight districts, six of those are on track, and we have a business metrics that we use to determine if they're on track or off track. Two of the districts are off track, and then we're going to have a 24-month review, and hopefully they'll become labeled on track. If not, then we will look towards our next level of accountability, which could include closure of a building or reconstitution of a building or some other methods that we put in place.
So if you had to close the school, I mean, what does that really look like? I mean, you've got the neighborhood to contend with. You've got the kids, and they've got to go to school someplace. So what does it look like when you close one?
Well, we have not closed a school, so I can't answer that question, what it would look like. The uniqueness of this is that we're trying to break down the barriers. We don't want to close schools, but, you know, we're not sure exactly, because we don't know, we haven't been faced with this, because when the state was saying we were going to close schools, then we went to the partnership model. So we haven't really got to that point yet, but if that occurs, then we're going to have to work with the district, and we're going to have to work with their community to determine where we move and what we do.
Bill Pearson directs the partnership districts for the Michigan Department of Education. Thanks for explaining this to us and giving us an update.
You're welcome.
A quick heads up, Stateside will be taking a break next week. In its place, we'll be airing interviews from the National Writers Series in Traverse City. It's a year-round book festival and a destination for conversations with today's finest authors. We'll be featuring some of the best interviews from the festival, starting with our very own Cynthia Canty talking with New York Times columnist and author Anna Quindlen. That's on Monday. Stateside will return on Memorial Day. Coming up, transforming the sounds of Michigan State Parks into a musical album. We'll explain after the break. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, you're probably familiar with the state's Pure Michigan tourism campaign. Well, that effort is now putting out Pure Sounds of Michigan. It combines recordings of natural sound at 10 of Michigan State parks with music composed and performed by several artists. Here's a bit of video on YouTube titled The Making of Pure Sounds of Michigan.
There aren't very many albums where you get this sort of diversity of artists working on the same thing and from the same materials. It's a really unique project where the bed for the music is all pulled from real world sounds.
The first step of the project was to send a group of engineers out throughout the state of Michigan to capture sounds, essentially capture nature at the source, and then bring those raw sounds back to Assemble Sound, where we've been working with the producers and engineers on the project and working on kind of crafting these ambient tracks.
Joining us now are Dave Lorenz and Eddie Logic. Dave Lorenz is the Vice President of Travel Michigan, which is in charge of the Pure Michigan campaign. Eddie Logic is one of the musicians involved in the Pure Sounds of Michigan project. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Where did this idea come from?
Well, it's really nice that we have a small but very dedicated and talented team. And our folks at our public relations agency, Weber Shandwick, along with our public relations team, came up with this idea really about a year ago. We're always looking for ways to kind of stand out from the crowd, to break through the clutter of the media, to get across the message that Pure Michigan is this very special place to live, work, and play. So they said, you know, no other state office has ever done anything like this, where we would record ambient noises from state parks and then mix them with music and then those sounds could represent the experience that you could enjoy if you were just to come to Pure Michigan. So that's the essence of the idea, and you know, thank goodness we have really innovative people who help us out.
Well, let's talk about how this all worked. Eddie, did you get to pick the natural sound you wanted to work with, or was it assigned to you? How did that go?
Well, I was actually one of the people who recorded all of the sounds and then kind of got to pick what park I wanted to work on, but all the sounds were divided and given to the artists by the state park that they were recorded from.
So what's your process for a project like that? You've got this ambient sound, and now you've got to come up with music that accompanies it. Do you just listen to the sound over and over again until you get something, or how does it work?
Yeah, I think it's just going through and finding something that strikes a chord with you. You know, the sounds recorded at the park, all these sounds can bring out so many different emotions in you, so it's kind of whatever sticks, and then you just kind of run with that. When we were recording it, we just wanted to record as much as possible, and anything that we thought sounded cool or could be used in a musical composition, we tried to capture and then left it up to the individual artists to really do what they wanted to do with it.
Dave Lorenz, why did Pure Michigan think it needed an album of music?
Well, you know, there are a lot of ways to inspire people to travel, especially on radio. We're all reminded when we hear certain things of something that we've experienced in the past. In my case, when I hear on this album, when I hear kids playing on a beach, and you can just imagine, you know, that they're playing there, they're making sandcastles, the water's coming into the shoreline. It just brings me back to better times, simpler times when I was a kid and enjoying Michigan parks. So with that thought in mind, and we knew that we have so many talented musicians in Michigan, we thought, well, let's blend these things together to inspire people in a different way. It is difficult to get across messaging these days with all the clutter of media. So our thought was, let's just find a different way to get across this message that Pure Michigan really is special. And if you think about the variety of park experiences that we're providing people in this final, it's really interesting because you have everything very different from like Tequamanon Falls State Park and that beautiful waterfall, wonderful kind of almost yellowish, brownish tannin waters that are very unique for a huge waterfall because of all the leaves in that area. And you just hear that thunderous noise, and then you mix it in with beautiful music. It really does bring back these, you know, thoughts and these images in your mind. It's the theater of the mind, really, and it all comes forward with music.
So how are you expecting this to be distributed? I know you've got YouTube videos. Are you hoping for radio airplay, Spotify, some other kind of online use? How will we get a hold of it?
We're on all the major digital platforms out there like Spotify, and if you just do a search for Pure Sounds of Michigan, you'll find them, free downloads. And actually, we did make a vinyl for media and for promotion, and the cool thing is if you go to Shinola stores and buy a turntable in June, you're going to get a free Pure Michigan Sounds of Pure Michigan as well with that. So just a fun way to promote it as well.
I want to turn back to Eddie in just a second, but Dave, let me ask you a couple of harder questions. Was this project paid for with taxpayer dollars?
Well, you know, with the Pure Michigan campaign, the dollars actually come from what they call the strategic fund. So we have a $36 million budget that we use to promote travel throughout the state. So we use that in a variety of ways, traditional advertising and public relations, and we do a lot of things with travel operators and such all around the world. But the fact is that for every dollar we invest in the campaign, we bring back more than $9 in tax return. So it's important for us to always provide a really good return on investment. And you never know about interesting and innovative projects like this, if they're going to really bring back as great a return as compared to traditional advertising. But I think this will. I think this will get to a whole new audience, especially millennials. It's hard to get to that audience. So you look for these new and innovative ways to inspire them to travel, to come to Pure Michigan.
Eddie Logix, have you listened to the other artists' work on this album yet?
Yes, I've listened to all the work on the album. I was the mastering engineer on it, so did the final touches on it, and everybody did a great job. It's really great to see a community of artists come together on such a cool project like this.
What wowed you the most?
I would say, well, you know what? Everybody really wowed me pretty equally. Being out there when we were recording all the sounds last October, to see what transpired from being out there in the field recording all this stuff and then beautiful music coming out of it. Because really, anything can be musical. So all these sounds were used in so many different ways to where they could be even be not just laid behind as a bed for the music, but synthesized into whole new sounds that create a whole new soundscape to bring back these memories and stuff of the parks and the great state of Michigan.
It is an album, so is there a story arc, an overall theme beyond just the sounds of Michigan that you want us to notice or hear?
There is. It's kind of a 24-hour cycle, if you will. It's kind of sunrise to sunset into the following sunrise. So it kind of takes you, if you're to go to one of the parks and kind of wake up in the morning and do your thing, go on a little hike or whatever, and then going down to the sunset at night and then waking up the next morning to another beautiful sunrise, that's kind of the journey that we wanted to take it on.
Some of the singles have been released already. When will we hear the entire album, or when will it be released?
The whole thing comes out on the 22nd, May 22nd.
And we should remind everybody, this is the centennial of state parks in Michigan, which is a big deal, too. So this is a little cake for them, I suppose.
Well, this, you know, it is the 100th anniversary, and this is just not Michigan proud guy here, even though I am, but we have the best state parks in the country. It's the truth. We really do. I mean, we've been doing this for 100 years, so they've gotten pretty good at it. So you look at the variety of types of parks experiences that you can have. I'm a hiker, so I just love hiking through beautiful forests. And you can do that, and then you can also go to, you know, parks with lovely beaches and go to some unique place like Mackinac Island and watch the horses go by. And the cool thing about this project is you hear all those natural noises at these parks mixed in with music from these really talented people. We look at research all the time, and people don't understand that Michigan is this very arts-friendly state, and people will travel for art as well. So we're hoping that this does a couple things. We're hoping it reminds people of the experiences they've had in the past and how they can have even better experiences when they come to Pure Michigan Parks now, and then visit Michigan and all the other things that we have to offer. But we also hope it will encourage people to go to our concerts and our events and look at our art galleries and our theaters and experience that fullness of experience that you can have, this very diverse place and very diverse people that you get to meet along the way. That's the nutshell of the project.
Eddie, I got one more quick question for you. You've been through this project. You've been working with ambient sound. How's this going to affect your music in the future?
I think it's going to push me to continue to use more field recordings and sounds that are around me in my music.
I like that idea.
And using experiences in music as well, because it's not just about the sounds. It's about the experience that those sounds bring out.
Eddie Logix is one of the musicians involved in the Pure Sounds of Michigan project. Dave Lorenz is the vice president of Travel Michigan, which is in charge of the Pure Michigan campaign. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Grand Rapids Art Museum is presenting an exhibition by an artist and designer, and chances are you already know some of her work. Joining us now is the chief curator of the Grand Rapids Art Museum, Ron Platt. Welcome.
Thank you, Lester. Hi.
All right, let's get right to it. What is Maya Lin best known for?
Well, Maya Lin is best known as the designer of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. That was in 1981. When she was a college senior, and what people probably don't know nearly as well is all the amazing work that she has made between then and now and that she continues to do.
You know, at the time, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial was very controversial. Why was that?
Well, I think that the idea of a memorial not taking a sort of a figurative form was something that a lot of people, I guess, had trouble getting their head around.
Right. We want columns and pedestals and statues, right?
Yeah. And I mean, there's obviously a place for that. I think there's a place for everything. But I think the fact that it's proven to be so very popular since its installation and since it's opened shows that the American public was ready for something much different and much more, a memorial that was also an artwork.
Let's talk about the exhibition at the Grand Rapids Art Museum by Maya Lin. It's called Flow. What is it?
It comprises seven sculptures. The name of the exhibition refers to the fact that water is its subject and focus. And the works are all large scale. A couple of them were created newly for the exhibition, and they sort of represent her different interests in scientific mapping and technologies, her real sort of savvy understanding of materials and what they can do, and then her just interest in the environment and humankind's relationship to the natural world.
Can you describe what one of them looks like?
You bet. I'll talk about the two new pieces. One is a pin river, and it is a representation of the Grand River watershed.
Oh, nice.
And I believe that starts down south of Lansing somewhere as a tributary. And so it is represented in the full river, its tributaries, and where it hits Lake Michigan. And it's a beautiful piece, and it's realized in steel pins, and there are tens of thousands of them that were inserted directly into the wall of the gallery. And it's remarkable how it is reminiscent of sort of a system within the body. And I think she's making plain the notion that the systems of the earth are just as sensitive as those within our bodies. Another new piece represents the Great Lakes in recycled silver, but the Great Lakes are only one part of the piece. It stretches 15 feet across the wall and shows all of the lakes, starting with Great Bear Lake up near the Arctic Circle, going down all the way through the Great Lakes, all of the lakes which were created by the melting and movement of the glaciers a long time ago.
Oh, wow. So how did this Maya Lin Flow exhibit come about at Grand Rapids Art Museum?
I think the impetus for us really was our desire to draw more attention to Ecliptic, which is the beautiful park that really is at our doorstep here in Grand Rapids, and which she created 20 years ago.
Right, that's in downtown Grand Rapids. It's an exterior exhibition or installation.
Mm-hmm. It's a remarkable piece. And so in addition to Flow, there is a smaller documentary exhibition focused on Ecliptic. It includes models that are rarely seen that we borrowed from the studio. We wrote some text, and we have some video footage that gives people a sense of like what the site was like before Maya was invited to create the park there, her conception of it, how she was wearing both two different hats sort of simultaneously. She was both architect, because there are buildings there, as well as artist.
You know, one of the interesting things I thought about that was the idea that Ecliptic is water-based and Flow is water-based. Is that something she does a lot?
You're absolutely right. I mean, Ecliptic is sort of organized around the idea of water in its different forms. You know, there's ice in the winter when the center ellipse is a skating rink. There's a vapor fountain which emits bursts of steam that go up into the air, and then there's a sort of a water table, a sort of subtle fountain. Another thing about the piece that I think is so remarkable is that it's kind of date stamped. If you think about the lights that shine up through the floor of the rink. They're based on a map of the sky above Grand Rapids at the turn of the millennium, which is, I think, remarkable, the sort of heralding of the new millennial. And that was another reason that we chose water as a theme for the exhibition, because we saw how much work she was making about water, although in these different materials and in different forms, on the floor, on the wall, in some cases actually digging into the wall. So we were really excited to explore these ideas with her, and it's been a wonderful experience having her here. And we, along with her, have been enjoying people using the park, because she's only been back to Grand Rapids a couple times since it opened. And so she loves seeing it in use.
We've been talking with Ron Platt, chief curator at the Grand Rapids Art Museum. The exhibit Flow by artist Maya Lin opens tomorrow and runs through September 8th. Ron, thanks for telling us about the exhibit.
Thank you, Lester. It was very enjoyable.
Still to come, our Friday political commentators discuss this week's federal indictment of a state legislator and the power of dark money. Stick around. We'll be back right after a short break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. You want new businesses and investors to consider your state, right? Well, Michigan is the first state in the country to launch a free web platform, which could be a tipping point for the state. It's called StartupMichigan.tech. Joining us now is Mark Davidoff. He's the Michigan Managing Partner with Deloitte. He's also the chair of Michigan Israel Business Accelerator, which is behind the StartupMichigan.tech. So how's this work? What's your elevator pitch?
Well, we're very excited about this. We have been, the Michigan Israel Business Accelerator has been working closely with our partners here in the state, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, and our other funders to leverage what Israel has to offer. As you might know, Israel is really the startup nation with over 6,000 startups. And there's an organization in Israel called Startup Nation Central that has a central database of their entire startup community. And they began licensing the backbone of that platform. And we're the third licensee in the world after Thailand and New Zealand, the state of Michigan, to be using this platform. And this Monday, Monday the 20th, we'll be celebrating Michigan's startup tech ecosystem, where we have now almost 350 startup companies embedded in this platform, which is available for viewing from around the world to tell our story about who we are as a startup community and to attract others to join us.
So if I'm a startup exec, how will StartupMichigan.tech help me beyond being on the net anywhere else?
Well, we will allow you to develop a page of your story on this platform. And because it's free and accessible and connected to the other platforms around the world as this Startup Nation Central effort grows, you'll be able to speak and to connect to other startups all over the world to see who they are, what they're trying to accomplish, where they are in their evolution, how you might want to collaborate. In addition, the funding community, venture capital, private equity, can also take a peek behind the curtain also for free, totally accessible, to see what we have to offer and what they might be looking for to add to their portfolio. So on both ends of the spectrum, it allows startup community and those who want to invest in it to understand the Michigan story.
You said you had over more than 300 involved in it so far. What's been the response?
The response has been amazing. And those 350 startup tech companies in Michigan, we have developed with our team here in Detroit by scanning the publicly available information. Now that the word is out, many of these young, early stage startups who haven't had a chance to tell their story are reaching out to us to develop their own page. And so we believe that the 350 that we have today is going to grow geometrically as this continues to be discussed and understood across the state.
While we've got you on the phone, more broadly, how well is Michigan doing in attracting new tech startups compared to other states or other nations?
Well, I think that we've certainly been in this space, you know, almost for a century. I mean, more than a century with the development of the automobile. And I think that oftentimes it's hard to tell your own story. And so, but I think between the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, the Right Place in Grand Rapids, Detroit Regional Partnership, and the other entities that are involved in telling that story on a cohesive basis, we are well positioned to continue to grow that space. And I think we have a great opportunity. Michigan has an enormous asset base. to offer the tech community. And I think we're well positioned for continued growth.
Well, we hear about California's Silicon Valley. We hear about Boston with MIT and Harvard and Boston University there, the Research Triangle in North Carolina. What is Michigan's reputation in the startup world?
Well, I think the fact is that we are well positioned geographically. We're well positioned from a quality of life perspective, from an economics perspective. And we are a state that has a tremendous platform on which to put new technology with regards to our commitments and longstanding history in auto and mobility now, of course, health and life sciences, agriculture, water, defense. And so we have many different swim lanes to play in. And so that's why I think we're going to continue to be very competitive in this space.
Do we have the talent in Michigan to attract startup tech companies?
100%. I think we all know that we have a rich talent base here, from engineers and beyond. And
but we keep hearing that we're losing the grads from our research universities, not being able to retain them. I mean, what kind of impact does that have?
I don't think that's as true as it might have been in the past. And I will tell you, just from a Deloitte perspective, we do a lot of recruiting at our great universities. And the fact is that for many years, many students, either from Michigan who came to Michigan to study, were only interested in positions outside of Michigan. That is not true anymore. We have more and more graduating students at our great universities who want to stay in Michigan, be a leader in moving our state forward, living in our great urban centers. And so I think that that's an old story. And the new news is that we're retaining those who were born and educated here, and we're retaining more and more who chose to be educated here to stay and make a difference.
You talked about, you know, Michigan and what it has. Are there other commodities that we don't have that are necessary to attract and retain tech startups?
Well, I think that, you know, the urban centers growing is an important, obviously transportation across the state is a key issue. And obviously that's a hot topic today in many different forms. So there's always going to be room to grow in the attributes of the state. But I think the more that we can tell the one Michigan story around the world, the better off we're going to be.
We've been talking to Mark Davidoff about the StartupMichigan.tech site and the economic climate in Michigan. Thanks very much for sharing your insight.
My pleasure, and let's make Michigan a winner as it always has been. And thanks for taking time today.
The story most of Lansing is talking about this week is the federal indictment of State Representative Larry Inman. A Traverse City area Republican allegedly solicited money from a union and a lobbyist asking for campaign donations in exchange for getting votes to stop the prevailing wage law from being abolished. For a lot of voters, this indictment affirms what they believe for a long time, and that is politicians are on the take. All government is corrupt. Well, joining us to talk about that are our Friday political commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. So, Vicki, how does something like this indictment affect trust in government?
Deeply. It affects it deeply. The idea that someone would be willing to sell his or her vote on a very important issue for political contributions is exactly why a lot of people voted for term limits, to get this kind of political undertone out of government and send citizen legislators who would be concerned with representing their constituencies over anything else to Lansing to legislate. This is a very, very sad story, if true.
Ken, aggravating this voter suspicion that so-called dark money, where we can't find out who's giving the money to campaigns, in itself, it's just legalized vote buying. What do you think of voters' mistrust of money in politics these days?
Protecting the integrity of our democratic process is very important, and it's critical across a number of issues. But Lester, I want to add a cautionary note here. You know, under our legal system, people are innocent unless proven guilty. And being charged with a crime is not the equivalent of being convicted of a crime. So, you know, I feel it's sort of incumbent upon me to add a cautionary note here to this individual case and not rush to judgment on this one person. But with that being said, protecting the integrity of our democratic process is critical.
And this is the thing that prompted the discussion this week. We've seen problems like this in the past. Government watchdog groups note that Michigan could be a lot more transparent about things like campaign finance and how elected officials deal with lobbyists and organizations that work to influence the government. So, Vicki, how effective would more transparency have on restoring trust in government?
It would be very important, but we're going backward. And ever since the Supreme Court Citizens United case that equated giving money to political candidates and the political process as the same thing as free speech, but doing it secretly, we've had this expansion, not just in the federal government, but in state and local governments, of dark money. And that is money that can't be traced to any particular individual. And I think it's important, if you're going to say something with your money, you should be willing to say it publicly with your money. And in the lame duck session of this legislature, even further restricted the sunshine laws by saying that the Secretary of State and the Attorney General's office cannot search for the names of contributors to these 501c organizations, these dark money organizations that contribute over millions of dollars to political campaigns.
Ken, what do you think elected officials should do to help restore trust in government?
Well, let me just say the combination of money and politics is never good. There's always a risk. I'm a big believer in just absolutely full transparency, if you will. I'm not a big fan of limiting contributions to candidates, but I am a supporter of all contributions ought to be open and disclosed, whether it's large committees or just contributions to individual candidates, because I think sunshine is the best anecdote.
I'm wondering whether either of you was ever approached with an offer of a campaign donation in exchange for a vote or votes on an issue.
Well, I never was. And let me just say this. Don't forget, we have 110 members of the State House serving every 2 years. And we have 38 members of the State Senate serving every 4 years. When you have one or two of these every decade, you see that the problem is not that widespread. Most people go into politics to serve their constituents and to make the world a better place. This is a rare occurrence, and as Ken said, if true, it's very sad. But part of this is the failure of the legislature to hold itself accountable for political contributions.
Ken, were you ever approached?
No, and I think Vicki's point is very important. The vast majority of people, either candidates, politicians, legislators, or lobbyists, are professionals. Generally speaking, the problems occur when they do occur, and they're rare. It's not from a lobbyist or a contributor per se. It's generally the legislator or the politician that makes the first move.
I'm wondering, why do people give money to campaigns if not to influence a candidate?
Well, I don't think you give money to campaigns to influence a candidate. You should be giving money to support the principles that that candidate will bring should he or she be elected to serve in that office. And that's where most political contributions come from. They know that lawn signs cost money, literature, mailing, etc., are expensive propositions, and they want to help you defer those costs by supporting you. And maybe we need to move to a situation where we have limits on spending and that we shorten the election cycle and we try to drive this dark money out of the political process.
Ken, you get the last word.
Well, I think Vicki's right. I think most contributions are, over time, it's generally made because a candidate or a politician or a legislator has philosophical compatibility with the group making the contributions. I do think the other issue is access. Contributions are often made just so they can get an opportunity to talk to the person about issues they care about.
Ken Sekema is with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislator. Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Thanks, you two. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Well, it is Friday. Might be time for a Michigan cocktail. Here's cheers.
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 Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. Oh my gosh, another absinthe in Michigan. This is good news, right?
It is good news, and it's a beautiful bottle.
It is. Very floral, and the color is very nice, too. Who made this? Oh, I guess it says in the bottle here. Let me see. Ann Arbor Distilling Company.
Right. So this is an absinthe violette from Ann Arbor Distilling Company. So it's not the green that we associate with the green fairy of absinthe, but it is a beautiful purple color.
Well, as I said, there are a lot of absinthes in the state now. Why this one?
It just came out on May 12th. And I was over at my friend's house on the weekend, and her bottle of it was almost empty. And I said to her, what have you done to go through that much absinthe?
That's very sad in itself. It's almost gone.
In such a short period of time. And she said, I've been making necromancers. So I had to run off and look up that recipe.
I don't think I've heard, I mean, I've heard in sci-fi about necromancers, but what is a necromancer?
So it's a riff on A Corpse Survivor number 2, which...
Okay, keep going.
Regular listeners will know is one of my favorite cocktails. And I was actually, as I was thinking about what to do with this absinthe, I was a little bummed that I couldn't make A Corpse Survivor number 2 because we'd already done one. And so this made me really happy that this is a little bit of a variation, which actually lets the absinthe shine even more.
So you stole the recipe from your friend?
No, I stole it from the internet.
Okay, that's our friend too, right? Okay, how do you make this?
So it's 3/4 of an ounce of the absinthe, 3/4 of an ounce of lemon juice, 3/4 ounce of Lillet Blanc or Coqui Americano, an aromatized wine. I happen to use Coqui Americano because I like it best. 3/4 of an ounce of Saint Germain, which we've talked about before as being an elderflower liqueur. It's a little bit bartender's ketchup, goes with everything. And then just a dash of gin. And I think they just threw that in there because the classic Corpse Survivor has a rinse of absinthe or a dash of absinthe. And so they're like, we'll give it a dash of gin instead.
This is another equal parts drink, though.
Yes, right. Just like the Corpse Survivor number 2, except we're taking the gin and using absinthe in its place, and we're taking the orange liqueur and using the Saint Germain in its place.
Did you get a taste of it at your friend's house?
I did not. She was going to make it for me, but I brought 4 tiki cocktails to our party, and so we didn't need it.
Well, go ahead and taste it. Tell me what you think.
Well, I always say that the first thing you do when you get a drink is drink with your eyes, and it is a beautiful purple color. The purple from the absinthe violette carries beautifully through. Taste-wise, it does very much remind me of A Corpse Survivor number 2, but kind of like on steroids, the absinthe is in overdrive here instead of just being a hint. But this is such a beautiful floral absinthe that works really well for me. So the absinthe is made from Michigan brandy. They started with native Catawba grapes and turned that into a brandy. And then they added star anise, wormwood, aniseed, and fennel to give those kind of licorice-y notes. And then the color is actually coming from blueberry. And then there's a whole host of other botanicals. So there's tons of really interesting flavors going on. And I think this drink shows them off really nicely.
Well, you had me at absinthe, so I'm going to take a taste, see what I can do with this. Oh, wow. That is, the absinthe is very forward. I've never had a drink ever with that much absinthe in it, except for, you know, absinthe the way they serve it in those fancy bars with the sugar cubes. But you're right. It's a little bit like the Corpse Survivor 2, but it's still really very well balanced.
I think so, right? Those licorice notes in absinthe can be overwhelming, but here they're well balanced by the other ingredients. And I think it's delightful. I now understand why her bottle is almost empty. The sad thing about that is that they sold out on the first day. The good news, though, is that they're going to have a new batch coming out early in the summer.
Well, cheers to us then for getting a little bit of it in this beautiful drink.
Cheers.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock, who's been laughing at my verbal foibles the entire show. Our executive producer is Jill Lindstroth. Contributors today are April Van Buren, Sarah Lisa, Joel Danilevitz, Timothy Sperlin, Anna Schlut. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.